The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So after the Prime Minister and other G7 leaders had a lovely barbecue on the beach in Cornwall this weekend, the rest of the British public are waiting to hear about what happens to us come June 21st next week. Katie, what's the latest that we're hearing?
So I think the direction of travel for some time now has pointed to a delay as something ministers believe is the most likely option. And overnight, we have to wait till 6 p.m. for a press conference from the Prime Minister. And I'm pretty sure we'll bring you another podcast after that. But the general expectation, widely reported, is there will be a 4-week delay. There will potentially be a break clause within that. So you, after 2 weeks, review the data, but ultimately stretching it to 4 weeks. And I think the thing to look for, which I think suggests that this is going to be bleaker than I think there were suggestions of last week, is that will Boris Johnson say, no matter what, you're going to open up in 4 weeks because this is about vaccinating more people? I think they think you can get 10 million more people double jabbed in that time. Or are we going to see something which we got hints of when ministers were taking to the airwaves, Dominic Raab among others, which is, can you guarantee, you know, that this is a final extension? Ministers saying, of course they can't. And in a way, I get what that is, because we are potentially, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with this fast-riding case of the Indian variant. But at the same time, if this is still about links between, you know, vaccines, hospitalizations, breaking that link, and particularly breaking the link with deaths, there was at least a hope that Boris Johnson, and perhaps he will still, stand up and say, we know the vaccines work. We're just a bit worried now about the slightly younger cohort and pressure on the NHS. We need to finish all the double jabs that are over 50. So give us to this day and we're reopening. I think that's what most MPs who are growing very anxious about this, and we know Tory MPs can be very, you know, anti-lockdown, but I think there are some who will are happy to have a slightly more cautious approach in terms of the Indian variant, but are really growing very worried about this idea of a never-ending section of delays, potentially, if you push it too late into the summer, not reopening properly all year, because no one thinks you're going to suddenly reopen for the first time in November. And therefore, I think they'll want to hear from Boris Johnson more clarity in that sense, and I think that's the thing to now look out for.
I mean, James, do you think the public will wear this? Can they, in other words, get away with it?
I mean, the question is, what is the point of this debate? If the government's argument is an extra month means that everyone in groups 1 to 9, these priority groups for the vaccine who account for 99% of deaths, have both been double vaccinated and are at the kind of maximum level of immunity protection that these vaccines give, then I think that people will accept it, because you can see that once you've done that, you can then open up safely. I mean, that's the crucial point. If it is just a more general, all cases are a bit high, and we're not quite sure what to do, then I think people will get much more worried. I think confidence in a full reopening will then begin to fall away, especially for the riskiest activities, things such as nightclubs, for example. People will begin to think, well, are you ever going to get to reopen them fully? Because, as Katie said, you know, as you get into the autumn, you get the normal respiratory diseases, you get flu and the like, and I think there is a general view in the scientific community that we probably have less immunity to this year's strain of flu because people have been out and about less, caught less diseases, passed things on. So, you know, what are you going to do if you get a bad flu season? And I think this is the other problem, is we can't, and this is, I think, is one of the very difficult things for policymakers. You can't uninvent this tool of lockdown. I think 2 years ago, if we'd been sitting around this table and someone had proposed this approach to disease, we would all have looked at that person and said, oh, come on, that's not happening. I mean, I remember doing podcasts, one of the things I've been most wrong about in this crisis, when China started kind of literally locking people inside their houses in Wuhan, saying, well, you couldn't do anything like that here, so we'll obviously have to come up with a different way of dealing with it. After Italy did something, obviously not actively locking people inside their houses, but, you know, banning people from leaving their houses, and it worked. You've seen it copied here, you've seen it copied pretty much around the Western world. And I think this is one of the the big questions. What is the point of this delay? If it is just to get more people double vaccinated, then I think that is acceptable. I think the other thing that we need to see today is ministers are saying, and this is true, that it is unclear yet to what extent the link between cases and hospitalizations have been broken. I think for that reason, as we get more examples of places that have gone through the kind of Bolton experience, high caseload, increase in hospital numbers, you see what happens, how long those people end up in hospital, how many of them. I think it will be sensible to look again at the data in 2 weeks' time, because if we have a clearer picture then, you could bring it forward. Now, obviously, you would need overwhelming evidence to do that, but I think it is something worth looking at, because I think at the moment, there is a debate between some ministers say what the vaccines have done is severely weakened it, rather than severed it, and so therefore you have to still go quite slowly. But I think, you know, as we get more evidence, we should look at that evidence. You know, data, not dates.
I mean, and James, the problem with copying China is actually that, you know, this country hasn't copied China enough in some respects by not closing down the borders properly. In some parts of China, if you go there, you have to quarantine for 3 or 4 weeks in a hotel. So, you know, they really control the entrance of things. Whereas
on the borders point, I think there is a difference about how your freight enters your country, right? Because the vast majority of freight coming into the UK is accompanied, e.g. it is driven in a lorry by a driver. And these drivers, the whole economics of this work, because these people travel back and forward rapidly, I don't think you can ever hope for the UK to replicate some of the border policy successes of Australia or New Zealand. I mean, I think it's worth noting, and this is not nothing, but, you know, even those people on Sage who are most inclined towards kind of border restrictions argue that kind of tougher restrictions on in travel to and from India, for example, would only have slowed the arrival of the Indian variant in this country by 3 weeks. Now, you can argue, on to use Boris Johnson's analogy, but that 3 weeks would have given the vaccines a kind of vital head start against this Indian variant. Look, we're delaying for a month. If you'd had 3 weeks, would you have had to delay for a month? But I am sceptical of the successes that a country such as the UK can have in terms of both accompanied freight. And also, I think there's a genuine, considering this country's links to the rest of the world, I mean, there's a genuine human rights issue about telling people that they can't see dying relatives. I'm not talking about social visits. I'm talking about kind of compassionate visits to see people at the very end of their lives.
I think James is right in the sense, I think it's hard for the UK as a country to replicate what even Australia is doing, for example, having such a tight border policy because of rate. And also, I think, to be completely comforted to Britain so people can't visit their family. But I think when it comes to the Indian variant, I do think Boris Johnson perhaps is not receiving that backlash, but is in a tight spot on it. Because we did have a situation where, by the government's own metrics, in terms of their system of red list, amber list, green list, I think lots of people were logically saying, why isn't India on the list yet? And I don't think it is a good look for the Prime Minister, because we have a situation where we know he was very, very, very keen to go on a trip to India. The day that India was put on the red list, finally, was the afternoon of that morning. What happened was they had announced that Boris Johnson's trip was cancelled. So the two did feel very linked. And I think lots of people said, oh, this is because of Brexit. Now, I don't think the trade deal was the main reason Boris Johnson wanted to get there. I think actually part of it was a calculation by the Prime Minister that if you went to India, you would be able to get more vaccines, because there were, you know, orders with the Serum Institute, and that being held up because at the time they were worried about rising rates in India for very good reason. And I think they thought by going out there, you'd actually be able to unlock some of the supply. Now, I think there has to be a conspiracy theory of that, but I do think that's a failure of judgment by the Prime Minister in that scenario, because we have a situation where it was delayed. And as James touches on, the obviously, you never know exactly what would have happened otherwise. But there's been plenty to suggest, actually, the fact that the Indian variant is so embedded now, you know, actually we could have slowed that, had more double vaccines, and perhaps having a much happier conversation on this podcast today. Now, it's all what ifs, but I don't think that the Prime Minister's off scot-free just because it was only delayed by 2 or 3 weeks, because that could have had a difference.
I think the point is that you can't hermetically seal any country. Even China has trouble with that, but slowing it down probably does help when we're talking about lockdown easing. And of course, that's the Labour Party's argument against this government as well, James.
Yeah, I think Katie is right. It's clear that number 10 were reluctant to put India on the red list because they believe that they could get hold of some of these Oxford AstraZeneca vaccines that were being manufactured in India, and that would have helped. What I'm saying is, I am not sure how much these travel restrictions in a country like the UK, which relies so heavily on accompanied freight, how much difference they make.
Is it really beyond the wit of Brits and Europeans, though, to double vaccinate the lorry drivers, to give them lateral flow tests at many stages along the way, to make sure that those people coming in and out are protected as much as they can?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you were looking for one, I think generally the right approach is to vaccinate by age, as the risk is so correlated with age. I think if you were looking at one group to prioritise, long-distance lorry drivers are an obvious group to pick. I think they are doing... I think one of the problems you do is if you do lateral flow as opposed to PCR, it's quicker, it's much less disruptive. But we also know that lateral flow picks people up at their most infectious, rather than people if they were kind of incubating the virus, I think is the general argument. So I don't think anyone's going to give the government kind of an A star for its border policy. I think that people are going to give the government a very poor grade for its border policy during this crisis. I just think that this is less of a dramatic difference in how things have happened than people sometimes suggest because of some of the structural issues in the UK.
And Katie, in my introduction, I mentioned the G7. We've spent 10 minutes of this podcast not quite talking about it yet. But give us an update. Was it a successful weekend for Boris Johnson?
I think number 10 are happy with how it went. I think that ultimately Boris Johnson got his in-person conference and there was lots of pomp to it. If you look at, you know, good weather eventually. But then also, as you touched on, you know, socialising, getting to meet people, make those connections. I think you can see how, I think, when they thought June 21st was going to be Freedom Day, which is a few weeks ago, it would have been almost a great setup to that, you know, the year opening up. And instead, you are getting a few people saying, well, Is that the right tone before you tell lots of businesses they can't open indefinitely? But I think in terms of the substance, what were the main parts of this? I mean, I think that Boris Johnson is happy with his interactions with Joe Biden. I think that although the Northern Ireland Protocol did come up and there was an escalation over the weekend in terms of the sausage roll of Emmanuel Macron taking, you know, very tough line. Generally speaking, I don't think that... I think there was a sense it could have gone worse. And actually, in terms of what the US president was saying, which is almost seen as the most important, this, that, instead of, you didn't want a situation where Biden was taking the EU side in a publicly obvious way. That didn't happen. And I think that the protocol did obviously create a dampener because it's a really serious issue and it did keep coming up. But I think where they managed to obviously find other agreements on things like vaccines and also looking at the position to take on China, I think there's a sense that, you know, good work was being laid there, even if not everything was fully pulled off yet.
James, what's your verdict on whether or not they came to a good enough agreement on China?
I think it's beginning kind of baby steps, moving the West into a better common position. I think you saw that, you know, Joe Biden is an easier figure to rally the Western alliance to take on China than other things. I also slightly take the view that, you know, Boris Johnson has just turned up at the NATO summit in Brussels on Monday and said no one wants another Cold War with China. I mean, you know, Boris Johnson is rhetorically very weary of that. But I also think in some ways, yes, Joe Biden can do some rallying of the Western alliance, but China's also going to take care of this itself if you look at its own behaviour, you know. I mean, just before Biden was sworn in as president, China secured a considerable diplomatic success in that it got the EU to sign up to an investment treaty with it. You know, that which was a wedge, you know, and the Biden administration made it, the incoming administration made it quite clear that it wished the EU hadn't done that. That is now stuck because China has decided to sanction a bunch of members of the European Parliament, including in an act of kind of almost reverse genius, people from almost every group. And I think one of the things is that China's own behaviour is going to slightly push the West closer together. I think one of the issues at the NATO summit today you're going to see is when Joe Biden first ran for president of the United States, the Berlin Wall was still standing. To him, Russia looms large in his consciousness. He is a classic Atlanticist, Munich Security Conference kind of guy. other US presidents are going to be more Pacific focused. So the question then for NATO relies on making the Americans continue to think that it is a worthwhile institution from their point of view. I think one of the big questions about NATO is what is NATO going to do in this great struggle to contain China? You had Emmanuel Macron before he came to Cornwall saying, well, no, China shouldn't be a priority for NATO. It needs to be, because that's one of the things it needs to do to keep the US interested. And I think that one of the big questions is, you know, can you reorient NATO so it does more work, for example, with the Quad, with the kind of emerging alliance of the US, Australia, India and Japan designed to kind of counter China in the South China Sea? I think that is one of the big questions here. I also think the other big question is giving up on the idea of, you know, China has huge amounts of investment to offer. And I mean, the danger is that kind of countries want kind of one last hit from that, if you see what I mean. I think that if you look at the way China has treated Australia, it shows you the dangers of building up this very close economic relationship with China. It's not like a close economic relationship with a classic kind of liberal democracy. China will try and use that economic relationship for political leverage. You see, slightly from a different perspective, that New Zealand has got itself into this boat now, where it, having seen what China has done to Australia, is reluctant, I think, to join certain statements condemning China, China's behaviour, because of this factor. So I think there is an element to which China, I suspect, will end up driving the West closer together. But I think there is also an interesting question here about the change in the fundamental... I mean, this is maybe a conversation for another podcast, but I also think it is changing Western conceptions about the state. I think one of the most remarkable things about this conference is... Normally, you'd think, given how much governments all around the world have spent during this crisis, that one of the big things at the conference would be, you know, how to stabilise public finances. Instead, very much the vibe was, here are another list of priorities. You know, the democratic world must start offering a rival to China's Belt and Road Initiative. You know, so financing for this, financing for that. You know, but the Western governments need to spend more on kind of strategic priorities and industry. I mean, we are clearly very far away from kind of small state era thinking. You had Boris Johnson deferring to Mario Draghi, of Italy, who was obviously in charge of the ECB and declared that you don't do whatever it takes, to basically say, Mario, you were a central banker once, isn't it right that we should all carry on spending lots of money, which we know is the Prime Minister's instinct, but you know, it's, and I think this, I think this is another interesting element of the ways in which the Chinese challenge, should we put it like that, it is shifting the attitudes of Western governments.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And do join us for our next episode after the press conference later today. Thanks for listening.